All right, thank you. Let me start with algorithm selection, how we can choose algorithms to reduce the risks of things being broken. I'm going to start with a scary pre-quantum example. So this is an attack strategy called combining congruences, and it includes lots and lots of algorithms. For instance, the continued fraction method of factorization, the linear sieve, quadratic sieve, the number field sieve, the function field sieve, and it keeps going. Things like the latest attacks against small characteristic multiplicative group function, finite field discrete logs. This is from 2013, and it's the same basic attack strategy. This is also, it's not just an attack against factorization and discrete logs, it's also a lattice attack. The best pre-quantum attack that we know against, for example, the Smart for Caltrin lattice-based system is exactly a combining congruences attack. So this is a scary attack strategy. It's something that lots of people work on. I'm only giving some highlights here of the names attached to some of the bigger breakthroughs, but there's more than 100 papers about combining congruences. It's something where lots and lots of people have looked at how far you can go and keep going farther and farther. Some of the speed-ups that you get out of this, if you look at, say, factoring, again, this is all pre-quantum. Of course, post-quantum, these are all broken, but pre-quantum, RSA 1024, if you looked at the speed of the continued fraction method, it was something like 2 to the 120 operations to factor a 1024-bit RSA key. Now with the number field sieve, that's down to 2 to the 80 operations, which is a much more plausible number. Similarly, for 2048-bit, CFRAC was 2 to the 170, number field sieve is something like 2 to the 112. These more recent improvements in combining congruences, those have not been applied to factorization, they've only been applied to, well, discrete logs, and some other things in the meantime, as I mentioned, have been applied to lattice systems, but who knows what the next improvement is going to be. We have a pretty good idea of the history here, the public history of these algorithms, but this past performance is not really a guarantee of future performance. What we want to know is what's going to happen in the future. And not just what's going to happen in the future publicly, we want to know what's going to happen for some attacker who maybe doesn't tell us what attack the attacker's figured out. I like to visualize the space of possible algorithms and say, okay, for each of the possible attack algorithms out there, of course there's too many to write down, but imagine all possible algorithms, and then put a height above each of those algorithms, which is how fast it is. So imagine what's the biggest parameter that can be broken by this attack algorithm. And of course it's different for different algorithms, so this is some complicated shape. And what we're trying to do as attackers is find the top of this mountain, or maybe mountain range. And it's not necessarily something even close to continuous. So at any moment, you know some algorithms, and then you try to improve those or find some different approach. And, well, we like to think that we're going to find the best attack algorithms eventually, if we put enough effort into studying algorithms for attacking whatever problem. Or at least we're going to find something close enough to the best algorithm, close enough to the top of the mountain, that somebody who chooses parameters noticeably above that will be safe. There's no algorithm that's much better than what we know. But how do we figure out how much effort is enough effort? Even if this optimistic view is true, that putting in enough effort is going to get us to approximately the top of the mountain, how much effort is that? If you see an attack where, well, combining congruences, again, it's been a wonderfully fertile area of attacking things. And if you look at that and see how complicated it is, just to understand what the current algorithms are doing, there's tons and tons of options. There's lots of dimensions in the attack space. There's lots of different paths that people have taken, and sometimes it's not clear how they can be combined. And these, well, anybody who looks at what's actually happening in the literature would have trouble saying, oh, yeah, we've explored everything. It's really a scary attack strategy, and who knows what the next improvement is going to be. Again, post-quantum, this doesn't matter because quantum computers seem to do something much better against all these same systems, but I'm just trying to give you an idea of what the risk management is like for algorithm design. As an example of people who believe that there's more to do, Antoine Joux has entered into a bet with me about who's going to break RSA 2048 first. Is it going to be computers that are running pre-quantum algorithms, or is it going to be quantum computers running quantum algorithms? And his part of the bet is that, well, RSA 2048, within 18 years, is going to be broken by some improvement in pre-quantum algorithms for factorization. My part of the bet is that it's going to be broken first by, say, Shor's algorithm. if nothing happens within 18 years, then the bet is off. All right, now, I'm not sure whether his part of the bet is more saying that, yeah, he doesn't believe that quantum computers are going to be built, or more saying that, well, he's scared of what the attack algorithms can do, these combined encumbrances algorithms can do. For me, I'm definitely scared of what combined encumbrances can do. I'm just more scared of quantum computers being built. So that's why I've taken my part of it. All right. Still in the pre-quantum world, people look for options like elliptic curves where it seems less complicated. The attack picture for elliptic curves, it doesn't seem like there's so many different possible attacks. It doesn't seem so complicated. It doesn't seem so foggy. It's not so hard to figure out where we are on the attack mountain, unless people have missed something really, really big. It's a much more static part of the literature, and this is not for people not looking at it. It's people have looked at all sorts of avenues, and it seems like it's been much more thoroughly explored. If you go back to the original paper on ECC, Victor Miller's paper in Crypto 1985, published in 86, then he says it's extremely unlikely that combined encumbrances is going to work against elliptic curves. And lots of people looked at, can you make it work? And, well, the answer, the modern perspective is there are a few curves which index calculus, so combined encumbrances, does work against ECC. The modern view is that it doesn't really matter whether you look at a group as an elliptic curve group or some other kind of group. What matters is the number of points in the group. You have some sort of algebraic group structure, something you can compute with additions, subtractions, multiplications, divisions, and then the number of points in your group divides the size of your field, or the size of the field plus one, or the size of the field minus one, or a few other bad numbers. That's exactly what enables these possible attacks to work, and those are exactly curves that we don't choose, and sizes of groups that we don't choose. So people, basically, this prediction has worked out, that basically all the different sizes of elliptic curves are, as far as we can tell, immune to this scary attack strategy. And all the attacks that we can find are a much simpler kind of attack where we feel much more confident in the security of ECC. Of course, that's the pre-quantum situation. And post-quantum, I'm not going to go through this slide, but funny slide from Tanya about some horror stories of what might happen in the future. Like, suppose you have that doctors will harvest your organs only if you have a signed certificate, you have personally signed a certificate saying, yes, I would like to donate my organs. Now, if somebody can forge the signatures there, then kill you, then you're in trouble. You might say that the killing is more important than the cryptographic part of this, but anyway, the question that she keeps asking people is, would you bet your kidneys on this cryptographic system? And the answer for a lot of systems is no. And in some cases, it's because we haven't studied the algorithms enough. In some cases, it's because, we know quantum computers are coming, and things will be broken. So, okay, are quantum computers definitely going to happen within any particular time frame? It's not totally clear. But as a matter of risk management, it would be irresponsible for the cryptographic community to not say, all right, what will happen if quantum computers come along? Let's say there's a 50% risk, 10% risk, 90% risk. It doesn't matter because the impact is so huge of having a quantum computer. It's going to be such a disaster for the public key cryptography that's deployed on the internet today that we really have to do something about it. All right, what do we do about it? Well, there are lots of options, and we have some of those options where people say, yeah, those have been thoroughly explored, the same way that ECC has been thoroughly explored for pre-quantum attacks. Most commonly named are hash-based signatures, good old McLeese, and of course secret key cryptography like AES-256. You have to be careful. I'm emphasizing the 256 because, you need to resist Grover's algorithm, you need big enough parameters for everything, and the same is, of course, true for McLeese and for hash-based signatures. If you can't afford these really conservative things, then, deploying something with smaller keys, say, or smaller signatures, that might be better than doing nothing and saying, oh, you stupid users, why don't you do something? If the users need something which is more efficient, then, we have to manage the risks of doing nothing versus the risks of deploying something that might be broken. All right, let me start with an easy case of how we can get these things actually deployed, something that's already been mentioned a few times, which is code signing. Suppose you have your operating system downloading an update. To say it's an Apple operating system. You want to make sure that that update comes from Apple and not from some rogue government like the government of North Korea. So Your computer is checking some signature that comes from Apple and making sure that the downloaded update of your operating system is valid under that signature. If the signature is invalid, then your computer says, no, no, wait, or at least hopefully it says, no, no, that's not a valid signature, throws this away, and this is really important to protect you. Otherwise, somebody just takes over your computer by giving you a bogus operating system update. Example of a state-of-the-art signature system pre-QAM is ED25519, which is what's used to protect updates of the OpenBSD security-aware operating system. Obviously, for post-QAM security, we need to take things like ECC signatures and replace them with something post-QAM. Now, let's say P is the pre-quantum signature system you're using, and Q is your favorite post-quantum signature system, maybe hash-based. We'll come back to the choices in a moment. It will make auditors happier if, instead of upgrading just to, say, hash-based signatures, if you upgrade to ECC signatures plus hash-based signatures. When I say the plus here, what I mean is that you take whatever you're signing, whatever message or your code that you're signing, and you sign with your system P, you send that signature along, and you sign with your system Q and send that signature along. So you've got a concatenation of two signatures, and the public key is, of course, the concatenation of two independently generated public keys for these two different systems. And this is something which the auditor looks at that and immediately sees, oh yeah, 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 this is definitely secure as long as P is secure or Q is secure, or both. If you're saying, oh wait, that public key is then getting longer because it's the P public key plus the Q public key, then you can just replace the public keys with a hash. Users seem to like having, say, a 32-byte public key. And whatever number of systems you're concatenating, you can make a really small public key. Of course, you take the original public keys and stick them into the signature, and then the user verifies, the verifier verifies the hash of those public keys. Actually, you can often get away with less than the complete public keys of the original systems because some signature systems, like hash-based signatures, regenerate part of your public key as they're being verified, and you don't need to resend that for the user to verify the hash. Okay, concrete example of something which it's not the smallest system in terms of signature size, but for most things it's just fine. Take ECC signatures plus Sphinx 256. And now Sphinx, for people who haven't noticed this performance picture, here's what it looks like. It's 41 kilobytes for signatures. And generating signature is something you can do hundreds of that per second, and verifying you can do thousands of that per second. So it's not the fastest thing in the world, but if you compare that to the size of an operating system update, 41 kilobytes is nothing. Even if you have some smaller application being updated, 41 kilobytes is nothing. And then the ECC signature on top of that is unnoticeable. And then, okay, so the cost here, compared to what you're protecting, compared to the message that you're protecting, the cost of having some big signature, it just doesn't matter. And also the CPU time for the generation and verification just doesn't matter. As I mentioned, adding in the ECC signatures, the cost there is totally unnoticeable. Of course, if you have to implement both ECC signatures and hash-based signatures, then, well, you have more code to check. But at least if you're using ECC signatures already, which most people are, then you have that code sitting around. You've already been checking that code. You need to do something post-quantum anyway, so you have to do the post-quantum stuff. So it's not as if we're going to be saving any effort by trying to say, oh, don't use ECC signatures. It's already sitting there. We already have ECC signatures. And again, the auditor looks at the system and says, yeah, I can immediately see you're signing that with ED25519 and with this other thing that I haven't heard of. That's at least as good security as what we had before. So it's easy to convince people to deploy this kind of thing, and it's cheap. So as soon as software for this gets written, it will be used. I should emphasize that saying, yeah, we can easily put these two systems together does not mean that we don't trust hash-based signatures as much as we trust ECC signatures. It's actually the other way around. We trust hash-based signatures even more than we trust ECC signatures. We're very confident in ECC signatures. Lots of people have looked. But if you compare that to hash-based signatures, if I had to put a bet on what's going to be broken, then ECC signatures, maybe there's some algorithm out there that we've missed. It's really hard to imagine that we've missed something about hash-based signatures. There could be some implementation problems, of course, we have to check for that, but somehow hash-based signatures are much more confidence-inspiring than ECC signatures are. However, for an auditor who's looking at the system and saying, hash-based, what's that? I've never heard of hash-based, and whereas I've heard of ECC, I've heard of N25519, the auditor needs some time to understand that, yeah, hash-based signatures are really, really confidence-inspiring. The auditor does not need any time to understand, yeah, you're signing with both, so the attacker has to forge both. That's just verifying a few lines of code, then the auditor immediately sees that, yeah, you've got at least as much security as you had before. Of course, after quantum computers, then people will start seeing ECC signatures being broken, and they won't see hash-based signatures being broken. And once it's clear that breaking ECC signatures is really easy, then people will just throw away the ECC signatures. You might as well make the system simpler, make it easier for people to do new implementations by just relying on the hash-based. So that's the long-term transition. All right, for the rest of the talk, the application I'd like to focus on where there's more serious performance problems is the World Wide Web. And let me start with the Internet Protocol as the foundation of how data is sent around the Internet. That's also what's happening below operating system updates, but when you're deploying more security in OS updates, you really don't have to think about how the Internet works. You just look at where signatures are deployed and put in something else. If you want to put in post-quantum World Wide Web security, then you need to pay attention to what's happening because there's serious performance problems. So let me start with what does the Internet fundamentally do? There are roughly 4 billion computers on the Internet, and they each have an address, 32-bit address. For instance, the pqcrypto.org web server has address 131.155.70.11. And this is some sort of geographically located thing. For instance, most computers around the Internet, if they see 131.155, then, well, they send it to their local router, and the router says, oh, 131.155, I know that's somewhere in Europe, and then sends it along to Europe, and somewhere in Europe, people will say, oh, yeah, 131.155, that's in Eindhoven. And then it continues getting routed until it hopefully reaches the right machine. Of course, another copy of the packet that you're sending, your computer makes a packet, so it's a string of some length. Imagine, say, 512 bytes or 1 kilobyte. And then that packet is dropped into the Internet, and if it doesn't get lost, it gets delivered to the final machine, and a copy gets delivered to NSA. That's how the Internet works. All right, now above the Internet Protocol, how do you find out when your computer wants to talk to pqcrypto.org? How does it find out that the address of pqcrypto.org is 131.155.70.11? I mean, you just fire up your web browser and you tell your web browser, I would like to connect to pqcrypto.org, and your browser then contacts some server, which is the pqcrypto.org name server, which has address 131.155.71.143. Your browser makes a packet, which is addressed to 131.155.71.143. That's the pqcrypto name server. And what the packet says is, where is the web server? www.pqcrypto.org. All right, and then in the same packet, there's not just a destination address for this string, there's also a return address. And that return address says the address of your browser, well, your computer, to deliver the response to your browser. And so the name server looks at that return address, sends a packet back to the browser saying that the web server has address 131.155.70.11. And that's how your browser learns this is the address of pqcrypto.org web server. Now, how does your browser find out the address of the name server? There's one piece of unexplained data here, which is that 131.155.71.143. And the answer, how your browser learns that, is that it talks to the .org name server. So your browser says to the .org name server, whose address is 199.19.54.1, it says, where is the pqcrypto.org web server? And the .org name server says, I don't know, but if you ask the pqcrypto.org name server, whose address is 131.155.71.143, then I'm sure you'll get better information. Somebody forged that packet. It'll be 131. Correct address is 131. Yeah, I'll come back to security later. All right, now, how does your browser learn the address of the .org name server? Well, there's some root name server. And your browser puts a packet onto the network. If it doesn't know where the .org name server is, your browser puts a packet onto the network addressed to the root name server saying, where is pqcrypto.org web server? And the root writes back and says, I don't know, but talk to the .org name server, which is at 199.19.54.1. Then your browser asks the .org, finds out the 131.155.71.143, and then asks that one, gets back the address of the web server, and then it can actually connect to the web server. All right, so the only missing piece here is how you get the IP address of the root name server, and the answer is that is listed in what's called the Book of Numbers, which is part of the Bible, which is already on your computer. All right, now your browser wants to talk to the web server, and it does that through something called TCP, the Transmission Control Protocol. Now, the motivation for this extra little complication is that, as I was mentioning, packets have some limited size, like, say, a kilobyte. That's going to be probably okay as a packet. It's generally safe on the internet today to send 1,280 bytes as a packet. Most of the time, actually, you can get away with 1,500 bytes or, well, in some circumstances, 1,492 bytes. The fact that this is not pinned down is totally stupid, but that's how the internet works. The original standards for the internet protocol said everybody has to be able to handle at least 576. But you could handle more, and that might be useful to be able to send more data. And when we start stuffing crypto in here, then it is useful to have more data. But, okay, the reality today is that you can get away with 1280, sometimes 1500, usually 1500, sometimes even a few kilobytes, but you can't really rely on that. All right, so figure a packet of 1 kilobyte is good, a packet of 2 kilobytes you're pushing. All of the web pages on pqcrypto.org are bigger than 1 kilobyte. I think the smallest one's about 4 kilobytes. So this TCP protocol, this allows you to download a file in multiple packets from the server. So your browser makes what's called a TCP connection to the pqcrypto.org web server, 70.11 was the address, and then inside that connection it uses the hypertext transfer protocol, says get the following web page, and the server responds with several packets which are the contents of the web page. And what do the packets look like on the network? The browser sends some random number to the server, says, let's synchronize. Here's a syn packet, which has the following 32-bit number. The server sends back to the browser, okay, I acknowledge your number, here's the next number, and then let's synchronize the other way with another random number. The browser sends an acknowledgement back to the server with that other number, plus one. And now, somehow, the browser and the server have some idea that they're alive and can talk to each other. And at this point, the server sets aside some memory, some buffers, in order to handle the data that it's going to be sending out to the client. The browser, whatever request it has, maybe that needs multiple packets, sends that data along to the server. Typically, just one packet is enough. And then it sends that packet to the server, where each of the packets is labeled by this starting random number plus the number of bytes that were sent. So if a packet has 10 bytes, then the browser will take the initial number, and then the next packet, it'll add 10 to that number and put in the original number plus 10. And similarly, all the data from the server back to the browser, that'll be counting bytes from the server, starting from whatever the random number was that the server started with. Okay, why does this protocol have these numbers running around? Well, the answer is that the internet loses packets. The internet does not always deliver packets. I don't know what the reliability rate is. If you measure any particular network, you can figure it out for yourself. But overall, I don't know how often the internet delivers packets. Is it maybe 99.9% of the time? Well, what happens if you're in that 0.1% where things are not delivered? So the internet will lose packets. And then TCP, suppose a packet gets lost coming back from the server, say. TCP labels each packet with how many bytes long it's supposed to be. And then your client, your browser, gets this data from TCP, gets a packet which is labeled with a number in the future, and says, wait, I'm missing something. And now both sides actually are cooperating to try to make sure any missing data gets through. Your browser could actually say to the server, hey, give me that missing data. If the server doesn't get data acknowledged, these acknowledgments continue through the whole protocol. If either side that's sending data doesn't get that data acknowledged, then it tries sending the data again after some amount of time, maybe a second, maybe faster. depending how fast the network seems to be. Okay, so if the packet is lost, it might slow things down by a second, a few seconds, but eventually the data will be retransmitted, and your browser won't get confused by the lost information. The internet also can transmit packets out of order. Sometimes two packets go on different routes, and one of them, the later one, happens to be faster than the earlier one. And TCP, again, unconfuses itself by putting all these numbers onto packets, counting how many bytes have been sent along. All right. Where does crypto currently enter this picture? Well, the answer is TLS, Transport Layer Security, formerly known as SSL, Secure Socket Layer. Now, this is a layer of the protocol that it takes streams from the client to server and server to client, and encrypts and authenticates those streams, producing an encrypted stream both ways. That's what TLS does. If you connect to pqcrypto.org just with standard HTTP, without HTTPS, without TLS, then you do what I've been describing so far. If you put in security, you say HTTPS, then your browser makes a TCP connection, and then within that TCP connection, instead of saying get the web page it wants, it says, oh, let's make a TLS connection. And then inside that TLS connection, which is somehow sharing a secret back and forth to encrypt data, inside that it's now encrypting an HTTP request. All right, what happens inside this if somebody decides to attack your connection by, for example, forging a DNS packet, like that 133 that happened before? Somebody points your browser to a fake computer. Your computer receives the data, and it doesn't know that that's fake data. Anybody can drop a packet onto the internet and deliver it to you. Your computer has no way to tell until it has some signatures, some encryptions, some authenticators, something which is making it hard for somebody to fake data. But that doesn't happen until pretty late in the connection. There's all these packets that I've been describing back and forth, and then if anybody forges any of those packets, then, well, what happens eventually is your browser says, wait a minute, I was expecting to see a certificate from the server that I'm talking to saying that, yes, this server has the certificate says that this public key is for the server to be pqcrypto.org, and the public key is supposed to be somehow signing or authenticating the data. Eventually, your browser will say, wait a minute, whichever server I'm talking to, that is not giving me the right signatures. And then your browser will fire up a warning, or maybe it'll try the connection again. But TLS doesn't have any way to recover from this. The best you can hope for is that your browser tries everything again. But DNS doesn't have any protection against somebody forging data. TCP doesn't have any protection against somebody forging data, except for these 32-bit random numbers, which are not so hard to guess, and sometimes people can see them on the site. TLS doesn't recover. It just says, oops, the connection is bad. I don't have the authentic data I want. So maybe your browser tries again, but this is after tons of packets have gone back and forth. Somebody just forges one packet. This is how the Great Firewall of China works. It doesn't like a connection. It forges one packet, resets your TCP connection. You could have gone through 20 packets before that just to set up your TLS connection, and then China sends one packet and your connection's broken. And then maybe your browser tries again, and another 20 packets, and the attacker sends one more packet, your connection's broken. You never get the data through. There's no recovery from this forged packet. What people have been working on nowadays is various new protocols which are trying to authenticate earlier, trying to say, let's see what we can do earlier in the connection in order to encrypt every packet and authenticate every packet so that if somebody tries forging something, we can recognize it immediately. Instead of delaying and eventually checking some signatures very late in the whole protocol, let's try to have already back in DNS and every packet that we're looking at, let's try to authenticate that packet. If a packet is forged, then the authenticator fails, and you just throw the packet away and wait for the legitimate packet. And if you never get the legitimate packet, if there's not the response you were expecting with the proper authenticator, then you try asking your question again. Same retransmissions that happen now. This way, if somebody forges a packet, it simply has no effect, because you verify the packet and see, oops, that's invalid. Advantage of this beyond protecting against denial of service is that once you've decided every packet's going to be encrypted and authenticated, then you can suddenly apply that to packet protocols like DNS and other packet protocols on the internet. You're not just working within a stream protocol like TCP. TCP, you have a stream of data, and then you're sending some crypto around within that stream, and if the stream gets broken, your crypto is also lost. If you have packet-level crypto, then you can apply that to streams working on top of the crypto. You can also apply it to just packet protocols, again, like DNS or BitTorrent, any protocol which is working over UDP. There's a little disadvantage of this higher security, which is that your crypto has to fit inside a packet. And this is one of the things that becomes significantly more difficult with post-quantum crypto. So let's look at how much we can split up the crypto that we want to do in a way that will fit into the packets that we're sending on the internet so that we can do something which is even more robust than TLS and actually get confidence-inspiring post-quantum crypto deployed. I'll start again with a pre-quantum example, which is RSA. The original view of RSA, if you go back to the original RSA paper and Martin Gardner's article on RSA, then these describe RSA as you have a message which is shorter than your public key, P times Q, of the person you're sending to. And you somehow exponentiate, you compute M to some power, E mod PQ, and that's your ciphertext. And then the receiver takes that M to the E and computes some decryption exponent, decryption power of that to get M back. And this has tons and tons and tons of problems. For instance, the message length is limited. Or more importantly, for security, somebody can take this M to the E and then modify it, multiply it by, say, 2 to the E, which shifts M, replaces it with 2M. So somewhat more modern view of RSA says we're not sending messages using RSA. We're sending keys using RSA. You take, say, a 256-bit key for ASGCM. So all you need to know about ASGCM, if you haven't seen it, is it's some symmetric cipher which also includes authentication. And then you take that 256-bit key and you pad it somehow, and there's all sorts of complicated padding mechanisms producing some sort of randomized number R, which is as big as the PQ, and then you exponentiate R, send R to the E mod PQ along that. And then what do you do with your ASGCM key? Well, that takes the actual message M and encrypts and authenticates that message. This is not as trivial to break as the original version, but it's had all sorts of problems. For instance, coppersmith's attacks. If your padding is not sufficient, not covering enough of the length of PQ, then coppersmith's attack just ignores the padding and figures out what K was, along with figuring out what R was. Leichenbacher's attack, a chosen ciphertext attack, is a complete disaster for a lot of padding mechanisms and something that's still breaking systems today. There's, on the theoretical side, there was a padding mechanism, OAEP, which was supposedly secure. And, well, maybe it's secure, but the original proof was definitely wrong. Lots and lots of problems with this. It's not something that's easy to get right and to convince people that you've gotten it right. Now, here's something much better, and this is due to Shoup. I guess it was originally published by Kramer and Shoup, but as far as I know, it's due entirely to Shoup. It's called the chem-dem approach. Now, this is something better to do with RSA. This says you have, well, you heard about this, I guess, an hour and a half ago, you have a key encapsulation mechanism and a data encapsulation mechanism. And what the key encapsulation does is, instead of taking a key and then trying to pad that and send it along in some encrypted way, you just take a totally random number, much bigger than the key that you want, you encrypt that, you send it along, and then you define your key as some hash of the original random number. So this key encapsulation, instead of saying, oh, I'm going to take a message, which is, in this case, a key, and send that message along using RSA, it says, I'm going to send along some RSA ciphertext which somehow encapsulates a key, which doesn't have to have been present in any way at the top. You just randomly generate something which is then, at the end, giving you a key. And this hashing somehow is a simpler data flow than any of the padding mechanisms and avoids all of the various problems that people have found with the usual hybrid view of RSA. This is also a hybrid, that there's a public key part and a secret key part, but it's a much safer way to do hybrid than the original type of hybrid RSA encryption. Once you have this secret key K, then you can use ASGCM to encrypt and authenticate your actual message. The authentication is important here because if somebody tries playing games with R to the E mod PQ, like multiplying by 2 to the E mod PQ, then that modification will end up with a completely random K, and that'll totally spoil the authentication, and that's how chosen ciphertext attacks end up getting stopped. This is something which doesn't just work for RSA. Well, you heard before how it works for, say, QCMDPC. It works for lots and lots of public key systems. Certainly, if you have any sort of safe public key system over here, then you can use it to send along a key. But this is much more flexible, because you don't need to start with a short key and then figure out how to randomly pad it. It's simpler, it's easier to get right. And if you want to combine multiple public key systems, you simply take several of these hashes and concatenate the inputs or concatenate the outputs and hash that, and then you have a key to use with the rest of your protocol. You reverse this order of have a key that you're going to use for encryption and then figure out how to public key encrypt it. Instead, you have some random thing that's public key encrypted and you just hash that to get your key. Okay. The security literature you can find on this chemdem approach says that DEMs have to be some sort of secure authenticated ciphers, where it's a little weaker than the normal thing that people are targeting with authenticated encryption. And I'm not going to go through the details of how this works. Tony asked me at some point, is it safe to use the same key K for several messages? And I said, well, it should be, but somebody should have studied this. And I was totally unable to find any literature on this. I will assert that it is safe to take a secure authenticated cipher and plug it in instead of the DEM assumption, assume full authenticated encryption security, and plug that into this chem-DEM approach. So let's call this chem-AE, chem-authenticated encryption. But some of the people who care about security proofs should be filling in some details here. Realistically, take anything like, say, SALSA 20 or ASGCM, anything which includes an authenticator, like the GMAC authenticator or Poly 1305, these are trying to authenticate, and they will be safe inside this construction, even if you use the K for many messages. If you're worried about having some security proofs, then what you have to do instead is use your chemdem for one message, where that one message is a key to then be used for many messages. So instead of having K being reused, you have M, which was encrypted by K, being reused for many messages. But this ends up using, well, bigger ciphertext and more complicated for, as far as I can tell, no reason. All right, how do we actually encrypt and authenticate data sent through the internet and, well, requests and responses on the internet? Here's a sample elliptic curve protocol called DNS-HERP, which is just pre-quantum, but let's look at the structure and then see if we can imitate this efficiently post-quantum. You start with a server where you have on every computer, including the server, including the client, you have some Diffie-Hellman secret. So the server has some long-term secret key S for elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, little s, and figures out from that a public key, which is big S, is little s times some standard generator G, some point on some elliptic curve. And the client comes up with its own random number, little c, and then sends along to the server that little c times the same generator g, and then some encryption of its query. The whole point here was to send a question like, where is this web server? So that's the query q. And the client encrypts that using the key k, which is a hash of cs, c times big s. So that's c times little s times the standard g. That's the usual Diffie-Hellman structure. You have a shared secret between the client with its secret key little c and the server with its secret key little s. They have a shared key, which is little c times little s times big G. And that gets hashed to produce the secret key k, the ASGCM secret key k, which is then used to encrypt the query and authenticate the query. And then the server sends back to the client using the same shared secret key k, which the attacker doesn't know. The server sends back to the client an encryption of the response, authenticated encryption of the response. Okay, before we switch over to post-quantum, let's view this through the chem lens. Diffie-Hellman is kind of hard to do post-quantum, but public key encryption and chems, those are something we have lots of options post-quantum. So, all right, to simplify what's going on here, let's assume that the client Diffie-Hellman share, the little c and its corresponding c times g, let's assume that that's used only once, which is some performance impact, but not such a big deal. So let's assume the c is used when the client starts this connection to the server, it makes a new little c. So this is independent of any other uses of the client. And now, I should say that beyond the performance consequences, there's also a security benefit to having a new C every time you're sending data out. It means that somebody who's looking at the CG can't link these different requests. Maybe they can see that you're sending requests from the same IP address, but if you move IP address, or you use Tor, or you do something else which hides your IP address, then this CG is the main way the attacker can link your requests, and by changing C all the time, you avoid that link, so you leak less metadata. All right, with this one-time C, what's actually happening here is what some people would call the El-Gamal chem, or let's call it the ECDH chem, where the client is sending along the secret key K encapsulated as C times G. And then the server can decrypt that because C times the big S, which is the thing hashed to produce K, that's the same as the server's secret little s times the CG that's sent along. All right, so very simple ECC chem, which produces a shared secret K between the client and server, and now they use that to encrypt and authenticate two messages. The client uses this key to authenticate and encrypt the first query Q. I've used this notation, encryption of 0, comma Q, to mean that there's a number being attached to each message, a nonce being attached to each message being encrypted, and the server has a different number from the client, so there's not going to be an information leak if R happens to be equal to Q, for example. Okay, now that we have this in the chem plus dem or chem plus authenticated encryption view of the universe, let's do the same thing post-quant. And it's actually pretty efficient. I'll start with McLeese as an example. So to remind you, in case people who've been here before or the last couple days haven't been paying attention, what McLeese does is it takes a public matrix, this capital S, is a matrix of, for a reasonable security level, let's say something like 7,000 times 5,000 bits. And then it multiplies that matrix S by what people would call the message, typically in McLeese. That's a little c. That's the client contribution here. And the client also then adds some error to it. So the E is some small vector of length about 7,000, small meaning not very many bits are sent. So S times C, that would be easy to figure out what C is, but adding some noise to that, adding the E, makes it much, much tougher. All right, and then the client sends along S times C plus E and hashes everything it's been looking at to form a secret key K. And then somehow for those of you who were here yesterday, you heard how using GABA codes, the server is secretly coming up with a structure in this S, which allows the server to work backwards from SC plus E to correct the error Z, figure out what SC is, and then figure out what C is, and then has all the inputs necessary for the hash. It's significantly smaller to use the Niederreiter chem, which you're hearing about this morning. This, instead of having a C and an E coming along from the client, you have just an E, and the C gets eliminated. The S here is a generator matrix. The S prime is a parity check matrix. If you multiply everything by S prime, that eliminates the SC, and you're just left with S prime E. So the Niederreiter chem says you have some random vector E, which is small, not many bits set. You multiply that by the parity check matrix S prime, which is now your public key, and then hash those together to form the secret key K, and the server decrypts in exactly the same way of, well, can take this S prime E to linear algebra to find an SC plus E, apply the original algorithms, or use something more tuned like you were hearing about this morning. The big advantage here that I want to emphasize is how small the ciphertexts have become. So now this S prime E, the parity check matrix, gives just 1,500 bits, something like 200 bytes of output. Instead of, originally, the SC plus E, that was more like 7,000, close to a kilobyte of output. So the McLeese chem has a ciphertext that mostly fills up a packet and leaves you very little room for data, whereas the Niederreiter chem is much, much smaller. Of course, both of these have a very big key, somewhat smaller for Niederreiter than McLeese, but You can make them both as small in systematic form, but they're still big matrices that you have to send around at some point. And if you don't like those big matrices, then you might prefer QCMDPC or Entry. So the Entry chem, just to remind people who haven't seen it before, you have some secret C coming from the client and a secret E coming from the client, and the C gets multiplied by the server's public key S, producing a ciphertext SC plus E. Well, it sounds totally different from McLeese. Okay, there are some differences in the details. The C, E, and S, these are now polynomials, modulo x to the n minus 1. So the linear transformation S, instead of being a big matrix, looks kind of random, it's now, that linear transformation is now a cyclic matrix, which is specified by just its first row, or first column. And then you multiply these polynomials, mod x to the n minus 1, and okay, instead of being polynomials of bits, it's polynomials mod q. That's the difference between Entry and QCMDPC. And then there's some secret structure which lets the sender figure out C and E given this ciphertext. Something that doesn't seem to be appreciated very much is that you can also make the ciphertext here smaller by using something very much like Niederreiter. And for people who are interested, you can look up, for example, LWR, learning with rounding, and ring LWR. All right, with either of these chems, maybe I should emphasize McLeese is the one that's been around longer, and we feel much more confident that we've explored all the attacks. Entry has had a much more complicated security story. But for everything else I say about the use of this inside this encryption, they're going to look exactly the same. We've got SC plus E as a ciphertext, and that's what the client sends along to the server, along with an encryption of the client's query, whatever that string Q is for the lower-level protocol. Of course, users, auditors will be happier if we put this together with ECC, but I didn't want to put extra terms into the equation. So the ciphertext can be a ciphertext for ECC plus a ciphertext for McLeese. All right, then the server sends back to the client. The server decrypts SC plus E, hashes stuff to figure out the K, and then checks the authenticator on Q, on the encrypted Q, decrypts and finds the Q, figures out its response, and then encrypts and authenticates that back to the client using the same key but a different nonce, encrypts 1, R back to the client, and now the client decrypts, verifies, and decrypts, and has its R. You might be worried that what's being sent along here would include a public key, because if the client's going to be talking to .org, and then .org says here's where the pqcrypto.org server is, and then the client's talking to pqcrypto.org, it needs to know what the public key is for pqcrypto.org in order to check that all the data it's getting, in order to encrypt to that server and get an authenticated response. So this R, the response that you get, could be much, much longer than what we're used to in DNS. Instead of just an address, or maybe an address and a little more information, it could be a megabyte-long public key. Even something like an Entry public key or QCMDPC public key is not very small. So the server, instead of sending along one encryption, one packet with one part of with the whole response to the client, it can send along one part of the response and then send encryption of 2, R to the client. And then, well, the client can request each of these responses separately. So the server is not going to just blast somebody with data. The client says, okay, what's the beginning of R? What's the next packet in R? What's the next packet in R? Can send all these requests along in parallel if the client feels like it has enough network capacity, and then the server, when it sees each request, sends back that chunk of R as a response. Okay. If the attacker is trying to break this, the attacker says, oh, I don't know what the K is, because that's hidden inside the ciphertext, SC plus E. I don't know what C and E are, unless the public key system is broken. The attacker has no idea how to decrypt Q and R, has no idea how to forge Q and R without breaking the authenticated encryption, the 2-DEM, I guess, authenticated encryption for two messages. There is integrity here. As I said, the attacker can't forge messages. The attacker could say, oh, I'm going to send my own requests and see what the responses are. The attacker could try tweaking something, but any tweak you can think of, it all gets caught by the authentication that happens at the end. The attacker can do one thing, which is replay the request. So the attacker can repeat the same packet from the client and then the server will send back whatever its response is. But in DNS, that's not a problem. Anybody who's listening for that response, if the client's still listening, okay, it gets the same response. Availability. So this is the difference between integrity and availability. Both of them are, well, trying to stop somebody from forging data. The difference is integrity means that if somebody forges data, you give up. Availability means if somebody forges data, you persevere and you continue getting the correct data. And then availability here happens because if there's any forged data, the client sees that from the authenticator, throws away the forged data, just completely ignores it, and then eventually the correct data gets through. Or if the correct packet is lost, then the client tries retransmitting its request. The crypto is happening at a very low level at the packets. Instead of waiting until after all sorts of packets have been sent, the crypto is happening as quickly as possible, as soon as possible, so that the client can go ahead and request all the data it needs. If it's not getting valid data back, then it'll ask for the valid data. If it's getting invalid data, then it will throw that invalid data away. Another potential size problem is actually, it's not so bad for McLeese, but for a lot of other systems, the ciphertexts are actually bigger than for the Niederreiter count. Raising the question of what happens if your packet is not big enough for the question you're trying to ask, plus the ciphertext. The standard answer to this is sending cookies. Now, a cookie is some encryption from the server to itself. So the client says to the server, okay, I'm going to have a question for you later, but first, can you please give me, I'm just going to send you a short request, can you please send me a cookie? And the server responds to that with, well, instead of sending its response to the question that it hasn't heard, it sends its response to the cookie request, which is, here is a blob of data. And the client can't understand that. It can decrypt this EK of R prime to get the cookie. R prime doesn't know what's inside R prime, which is an encryption to the server, from the server to the server, to the server secret key, which says, okay, I'm the server. Here's a note that I've written on myself on my cookie, which says that I have the secret key K for talking to this client at this IP address, whatever context, whatever state the server wants. And then the server doesn't have to retain this information. It's just sent it back to the client. And now the client sends along this very short R prime along with its long request. And then the server says, okay, let's look at that R prime. That's a message from me to myself. I don't know how many people saw the Memento movie. That's what cookies are doing. And then the client R prime is something the server understands, recovers the K, is able to decrypt, verify and decrypt the client's request, and then sends back the actual response. And so this chops up the packets even more. It takes an extra round trip between the client and the server, but maybe the client can prepone the cookie request, do that earlier before it even knows what the query is, as long as it has some idea which server it wants to talk to. Okay, and then this fits data into packets by using more packets, but in a cryptographically secure way. I've been talking about just a simple request response, which you can imagine being, it's like an online version of signatures. Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to verify a signature, I haven't used signatures at all here. It's just public key encryption for protecting IP packets. Okay, there's more complicated protocols than request response. You could have lots of queries, lots of responses in whatever pattern. You could have a whole connection, a whole secure session, and that's fine. You can reuse the same key K. Once you've sent a key K with whatever public key system, as long as you have a secure session, secret key, secure session protocol, then you can use that with your secret key K. Now, TCP at this point is actually a little more vulnerable to denial of service than what I've described before, that I said the server, when a connection is made, the server allocates some memory to handle that. And while we're dealing with other security problems, let's try to deal with this too. TCP allows easy denial of service by somebody connects to the server and the server uses some memory for that. And then connects to the server again, server uses some memory for that. The only protection right now is that the server allocates memory after it's sent back after it's seen the repetition of this 32-bit number, but anybody who's watching the network can continue sending more requests. And then, well, this is not really a solution saying I'm going to only allocate memory after I've seen some sort of cookie, even if it's a cryptographically secure cookie. Suppose the client is willing to say, yeah, I'm here, and now I'm going to fill up your memory. So now you know, yeah, the client is there, it was able to receive the data, somehow see the data I was sending, but it still filled up memory. What we actually want is the server to not have its memory filled up by an attacker. Just knowing where the attacker is doesn't solve the problem. An actual solution is to have the client paying, for instance, with Bitcoin or other forms of hash cash for the resource use on the server. Another solution is to have, instead of having connections which need storage on the server, have everything driven by the client. Like in the network file system, if you want to request different parts of a file, you just send a request saying, give me the first part, just like I was saying before, send a request saying, give me the second part, and so on. And each request, the server says, oh yeah, here's that chunk, and then forgets everything. The server doesn't need more memory for every client. Now that's not good enough for, say, SSH. SSH, you really are running a program using some memory on the server, and the server should not do any of that, should not allocate any resources until the client is authenticated. And to authenticate the client, you can do exactly what I've been describing for the client knowing which server it's talking to. Instead of having the client sends data, sends a ciphertext to the server, which only the server can decrypt using the server's public key, the server sends something back to the client's public key. And then that key, the decapsulation of the ciphertext there, the client and the server integrate into the shared secret. All right, I have a few more slides, and then I'll finish. These last slides are about the problem of having big keys. Now, I've mentioned that, yeah, that at some point, if you want to know the public key of some server that you're going to talk to, then, well, you have to find out what that key is, and that might need many packets. Well, quantitatively, is this a problem? Say we need 1 megabyte for McLeese. As Tanya mentioned yesterday, maybe we can get away with less, 512K or 256 for good security, but right now, based on the security analysis, we would recommend 1 megabyte. Is it a problem for each public key to use 1 megabyte of storage? Or do we have to switch to something like Entry, use smaller public keys? Well, one way to put this in perspective is to look at the average web page, which is 1.8 megs. So is it a problem if a key is 1 meg and the web page is 1.8 megs? Well, it depends how many keys do you get versus how many web pages do you get. One web page might be talking to several servers with different public keys, and you have to get those public keys. But when you get many pages from a single server, you can reuse the public key for that server. And that many pages, many reuses for a public key can be a much bigger speed up compared to the web page needing several servers that it's talking to. That's not something that expands dramatically. There's one limitation on this speed up that I've just mentioned of getting many pages from a server and just reusing that server's public key. I mean, if you get, say you get 1,000 pages from Google, then you can reuse the Google public key unless Google switches public keys. And the motivation for this is somebody wants forward secrecy. I'm really disappointed with how a lot of people think that elliptic curve forward secrecy, like ECDHE, is going to protect them against quantum computers. It's totally wrong. The only thing it protects against is if somebody steals your computer or forces you to get data out of your computer somehow. And that theft is going to allow them to decrypt connections that you've previously made, packets that you've previously sent, unless you throw the keys away from your computer. So, okay, people like to switch keys. For instance, Microsoft's SSL implementation, S-Channel, every 2 hours it switches to new keys. I'm not sure 2 hours is a very good amount of time for this. This choice, it doesn't really seem performance motivated. Somebody didn't really think through what happens with 2 hours. What happens with 2 hours is the secret police say, ooh, here's a connection, and now within 2 hours we can go grab the human rights worker or whoever has just sent that data. If you switch keys every minute, you're pretty much immune to this. So, okay, let me focus on the every minute. It might not be as easy for software as having each connection having a new key, but let's say 1 minute is good security and not too hard to implement. How expensive is this? Well, if the server every minute that somebody's talking to it makes a new key, and that means there's a new key generation at most once per minute, which for most systems is not a problem. And then the client, every client talking to that server has to do an encryption to that new key, and the server has to decrypt that ciphertext from every client that it's talking to. Maybe the costs here are better if you flip them around. Maybe the client should instead make a new key, And that's just as good for getting forward secrecy. The server then sends something to the client, which the client is then going to throw away its key eventually, and then nobody will be able to decrypt. So the client, if the client makes a new key, then the client generates the key instead of the server. The client also does a decryption instead of the server, and the server is left only with encryption. The big cost here is the bandwidth, the transmission. For every client-server pair that are active, whoever generates the new key, the client-server pair is going to be sending that key through the network. All right, last slide. A question that comes up here, if you want to switch to the client generating new keys, and you have servers being stateless that are when the client isn't authenticated, then you run into this question of how do you have a stateless server receiving a big ephemeral one-minute key from the client and encrypting to that key without storing it. And this is a funny little problem where the details of the answer are different depending on what kind of system you're looking at. For McLeese, for example, you can chop up the McLeese matrix so that when you multiply the McLeese matrix by whatever E, then you can do that in chunks, and where each chunk is producing a small piece of the output. So the client sends slices of its new public key along to the server. This is, say, 1 kilobyte slices of its key. The server takes each slice, multiplies by whatever, and then sends back a small partial encryption as a cookie encrypted back to the client. Client doesn't understand it yet. Then the client takes a bunch of those small cookies, sends them back to the server. You might need multiple iterations. Each level of the tree squishes the data by some amount. And then at the end, the server sees, here's the grand unified combination, and actually sends that to the client in a way that the client can decrypt. And now the client can see whatever the ciphertext was from the server, combining all these slices. You have to be really careful how you handle randomness here, because the randomness that's used for each of the slices has to be the same. And the server has to be able to enforce that without seeing at each moment what all the slices are. So a solution to that is you take a hash of the whole public key, which is done as hashing a bunch of hashes for the separate slices in a tree. You take that hash and deterministically hash that on the server side with a server secret to make the random number, which is then used for all of the random pieces of the encryption for all the different slices. The server can verify without any storage that you are hashing all of the pieces of the key together correctly into what was claimed at the beginning to be this randomness. All right, I'm out of time. There's a lot more problems that need to be solved to actually get stuff deployed on the internet, but we're working on this, and I'm confident that we're going to get something deployed this year that people can play with, that people can say, yes, here is something which at least has a chance of protecting them against future quantum computers. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dan. I think we can take a few questions. Randy?
So I'm just curious, what did you bet with Antoine Joux? What is the price?
What is the price?
Okay, yeah, so I think everybody heard the question based on the level of laughter. The prize for this is 700 milliliters of at least 18-year-old Scotch whiskey. Now, there's a little problem there. If we buy if we buy young Scotch whiskey now, and you assume nothing's going to happen within, say, 12 years, suppose you buy 6 years Scotch whiskey, then, you can play games there anyway. So the expense of actually fulfilling the bet depends on exactly what the time frame is, but anyway, that's the price.
Another question? No, so...
You mentioned providing an implementation to play with. What are you looking to provide, or...?
Yeah, so most important for people to be able to experiment is a Unix-type tool. There are various tools like S-Tunnel and SSLWrap, SSLWrap was one of the earliest tools that's modular that allowed people to take whatever sort of Unix kind of servers and drop SSL in front of those. And that turns out to be a good interface if you want to play with something new. And that's also what I envision as the first thing deployed for post-quantum. It does mean that you have to have whatever server willing to take connections in the Unix style, but that's a pretty common thing. And then internally, well, we're discussing what to do with like library interfaces and stuff like that. But for somebody to be able to actually try out, okay, here's what secure post-quantum solutions look like, having something which you can drop in front of an existing modular Unix-style server, that seems the easiest way to go.
Here. Do I understand correctly that you would like to see more schemes for signature speed message recovery that are post-quantum secure? Is this an interesting paradigm for people to be able to watch?
So message recovery is a somewhat different question from chems. Where did I put the chem slides? Here we go. So in message recovery, the typical situation, let me say signatures, for example, both for signatures and encryption, you can try to say, instead of having like your random numbers stuck in part of the ciphertext, you can also try to have like part of your message and this randomness both stuck in, which is a weird kind of twist of the hybrid version. There are some analyses of what this looks like with chems, but it kind of brings us back to the complexity of the hybrid approach for, I would say, not so much benefit. If you've got a pretty big ciphertext and you're trying to squeeze everything you can into a packet and you don't have any other way to do it, then maybe coming back to a kind of combination of a message and some random padding, which can be fairly space efficient, maybe that's the right thing to do. And in general, I think it's interesting to look at what we can do to save space in the context of internet protocols. But I also think that with the simple tools that are available, with the simplest approaches to post-quantum public key encryption, we can already fit things down. So let's try doing that. And there's going to be enough implementation problems with getting a simple thing working properly, not having all sorts of security flaws. And then there will be a next generation of trying to do things better in a way that, is more efficient. But there's lots and lots of cases where people, even a 1 megabyte key is not actually a serious performance problem for people. 200-byte ciphertext, even bigger ciphertext, are not actually such a problem for people. You just have to be careful where you're putting the data, what gets encrypted, what gets put into each packet. And I really think this can be done without doing anything really complicated with the primitives.
Okay, so I think we have to stop now. So thank you very much again.